House Transportation will come to order. Today is Monday, May 24th, and it's great to see all you bright-eyed and happy people here ready to go. Thank you, committee, for being here, and we'll go ahead and get started. And I'm going to ask for Keith Levitt to come forward.
What?
We can talk about all the great things that are happening at the port. Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Keith Levitt with the Port of Portland. I manage our properties and business development in the Marine and Industrial Development Division of the Port. I'm going to try to load up my PowerPoint here. Okay. Let's do that one.
Here's the mattress and important information.
Madam Chair, while he's loading his PowerPoint, I have a newfound respect for anybody having anything to do with any cargo containers. After I spent 3 days up in Canada, Port of Vancouver, and on a border security tour, and we were taken through some of the cargo farms, if you will. It's incredible, and those things move within 3 days. It's just like, how do they keep track? And so my hat's off to you, Keith.
I don't actually do it, so I'll have to compliment the other guys at the port that do it. So thank you, though. So today we actually have, I think, some good news stories today. We've had some recent announcements at the port that are, I think, bode well for the future of trade in the state and particularly for all the businesses in Oregon that rely on containers and containerized movement of goods for their livelihood. See if I can do this right. Just arrow down.
I wonder where to go to.
Well, we can look on this.
Need to borrow my hammer?
And see if he...
Got a wrench.
So he doesn't have a problem with
that. Yep. Okay, that one. Space bar works. Okay, so I'm going to give a quick overview of the port and particularly our container line of business, and then we'll talk about a couple of recent deals that have been through our port commission in the last month that I think will not only be good news for the port and for Oregon, but for a lot of our businesses throughout the state. I think you all know really the history of the Port of Portland. We started in the late 1800s for the express purpose from the Oregon legislature to dredge a navigation channel from the ocean 105 miles upriver to Portland. And that whole dredging mission actually continues for the port. We continue to own a dredge in partnership with the Corps of Engineers. We are nearing completion of a 43-foot navigation channel. We're 1 year away from being done with that project. And that is to really to the benefit of the state. The legislature kicked in a good $28 million of funding support for that project, along with the state of Washington, to match federal dollars. And so channel deepening, maintenance dredging, channel improvement dredging is a real key to the livelihood of the port and to the broader region. Why are we are really born from our geography, which not only is due to the commerce on ocean-going commerce, but also to a great network of rail infrastructure that culminates in Portland, both the Union Pacific and Burlington Northern Santa Fe, Their West Coast, Pacific Northwest operation really forms a nexus at port facilities. They go up through the Cascade Mountain Range on both sides of the Columbia River. At river grade, it allows for high-volume unit train activity into the Midwest of the United States. And when you couple that with the Interstate 5 and 84 north-south, east-west, east-west connections, we have great trade-related transportation infrastructure, and that's really why our economy has been able to grow its traded sector. The river system, as you know, extends well beyond Portland. It goes 465 miles inland all the way to Lewiston, Idaho, on a series of locks and dams. So what we are able to form with that is an export funnel for the world. We're one of the largest bulk agricultural export river systems in the world. And so the rail, the barge, the deep draft navigation, and the interstate highway system all form that kind of infrastructure to allow our economy to grow. Port facilities, we are located all the way from downtown Portland. Let's see if I can use the pointer here. Starting from downtown Portland, Terminal 2 is our general cargo facility. Terminal 4, further downriver on the Willamette, is a major Toyota auto import facility. Moving downriver, the Rivergate Industrial District is one of the largest industrial parks in Oregon. Over 800 acres of industrial complex. Terminal 5 and Terminal 6 are both international marine shipping terminals. At Terminal 5, we have Columbia Grain, which is one of the major exporters of grain on the river. Also at Terminal 5, we have Canadian potash that is mined out of Saskatoon and comes down from Canada in unit trains through Portland for export, particularly to Asia. This is used in fertilizers. Terminal 6 is our international container shipping terminal, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. West Haden Island, you can see in the foreground there, future potential marine facility development, very much in the future. Portland International Airport, and then out the Columbia Corridor, you can see Troutdale and then Reynolds Industrial Site. We have, I'll just kind of talk about a couple key areas of focus for the Port of Portland. One is how we retain and expand international service to our market. That's both on the marine side and on the air side. We happen to be, from a container standpoint and from an air service standpoint, relatively small market compared to other West Coast ports. So we have to be we have to work well with our businesses. We have to aggregate demand. We have to create a good value proposition to carriers, air and marine carriers, to come and serve this market. And that's an ongoing challenge that we have, and that's part of what we'll talk about today. The other area of focus for the port in our strategic plan is industrial land acquisition and development. We recently acquired a 750-acre site in Troutdale. This has been a great brownfield Superfund success story. FedEx Ground will be opening this fall. Your work last session is a key reason for that. We were able to secure major transportation investment that's going to allow that development not only with FedEx to be successful, but to be able to grow into a major industrial park in the future. But brownfield redevelopment within the urban growth boundary, very, very complex, takes a lot of patient capital, and this is an area that we believe the region in the Portland area, and I could extend that up and down the I-5 corridor, certainly in the Willamette Valley. You know, we're lacking readily available industrial sites that are development ready, and so that's something the port is particularly focused on. And we'll continue to have discussions with Business Oregon and the legislature about how to do that.
Do you want to answer questions as we go along?
Sure.
Okay. Representative Shaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Leavitt, the other night on election night, somebody made the assertion that it's people like me that are in the way of building a new bridge, even though the people that design it, contract it, construct construct it and use it would laugh at that virtually incredibly absurd suggestion. How much importance, when you talk about containers, I just had to get that on the record, Madam Chair. How much importance for your container industry is improving our ground transportation infrastructure, specifically the Columbia River Crossing Bridge? And I have one more question after that, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, very important. It's why we've been working on that project for many, many years, and we're hoping that it ultimately gets done. It's critical to the economy in general, and for freight transportation, it's absolutely critical.
One more, and then I really think when we discuss things like river cleanup, we need to take industry along with us and not just shove them aside and think that their opinion doesn't matter. There seems to be some controversy along those lines in the Portland area between the city council and the people along the river that actually create jobs and provide us with revenue in the state. What's your opinion on the Portland River cleanup plan? Is the port taking a position? What do you have anything to share with us on that today?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, we've worked with a coalition of the businesses in the lower Willamette to try to speak with one voice with the city of Portland and with the mayor and others on the river plan. We have been concerned that it adds an unnecessary new regulatory structure to an already heavily regulated area when you deal with a Superfund area. And so the concern is that those upland sites are really the major area of industry in Portland. And we have to find ways to free up the regulatory complexity so that we're able to have jobs there in the future. Right now, those sites there's not a lot of activity happening, not a lot of investment happening in some of those key industrial areas.
And Madam Chair, I got to tell you, the last sentence right there, there's not a lot of investment. It's not unique to the Port of Portland. It's a statewide problem, and it's our problem. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Just some statistics about trade and transportation and the importance to the Oregon economy. I won't go through all of these bullets. You've probably seen some of this before from us, but you know, Oregon is the ninth most trade-dependent state in the nation. We do have a particular dependence on exports, which is somewhat unique to our market compared to other port areas who are oftentimes, again, much larger consumer bases. Imports can tend to drive their economy more than it does here in Oregon. Fifth largest export supported job base in the U.S. These are very good jobs. We've been trying to make clear how important trade and transportation is just from a job standpoint, from port facilities with our industrial parks, with our marine terminals and jobs at the airport. We know that they're good paying jobs. There are fewer barriers to employment. And when you look at export sales, particularly during the recession that we've had, it's an amazing relationship between job loss and loss of export sales, and that's the final bullet there.
One more question.
Yeah, now shut up, Madam Chair. Thank you. I read somewhere, correct me if I'm wrong, that one in nine jobs in the city of Portland, in the Portland metropolitan area, are directly related to the Port of Portland. Is that an accurate statistic?
We'd have to chase that one down to verify, but it sounds pretty close.
I think it was a Port of Portland brochure. I read that up. All right, thank you.
Representative Berger.
Yeah, Keith, your first stat up there, the fifth largest exports per job base, is that a per capita or an absolute? I mean, are we comparing ourselves to California and New York?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, I believe that's per capita. Double check that.
Because the difference is significant. If we were actually fifth, that would be
first one.
Like huge. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Maybe drill down a little bit more now on Terminal 6. We have operated, this is our container facility. Terminal 6 has been operated by the port since 1974, and I would say Terminal 6 is very much a partnership between the state of Oregon, the state legislature and the Port of Portland, more than perhaps any of our other facilities. You all have stepped up with various funding sources to be able to fund infrastructure, equipment, cranes at Terminal 6. That has been just critical to the port retaining and hopefully expanding in the future that business. It's a 192-acre facility. Our current users, the alliance of what we call CKYH, this is Hanjin, Costco, K-Line, and Yang Ming, provide a weekly Asia to Pacific trade link for the Portland area shippers. Hapag-Lloyd, every 10-day service to Latin America, Europe, and the Mediterranean. We also have what we call break bulk activity at Terminal 6 at Berth 603. Ebraz Oregon Steel Mills imports steel slab to transport to their Rivergate manufacturing facility, and that's a significant job generator as well. This terminal serves more than 1,000 businesses throughout Oregon, located in probably every county in the state. In fact, I'm sure every county in this state, and then throughout the region. Those businesses really rely on having the direct calling carrier service coming to Portland to really avoid the additional transportation costs to make it to another port city for export. And so that's been the real key challenge, is trying to keep cost competitive carrier services coming to Portland to serve our cargo market. We have, this is also, the terminal itself is a significant job generator in direct jobs. 1,400 jobs, these are longshore jobs, trucking, stevedoring, shipping management, folks involved in the supply chain, all directly employed because of the activity at Terminal 6. So it's a very volume-dependent business. With increments of volume, jobs go up. It's a very quick stimulus that way. And so strategies that allow us to draw more carrier service and more volume to Portland, direct job increase will happen because of that. Next two slides just give you a sense for the capture area. We view really the broader Pacific Northwest as our capture area. More specifically, you can look at, you know, where if you're a company in Boise and you're shipping, you have export containers that are headed to Asia, Portland is the least cost port for you to go through, provided that you can catch a ship there. And that's the chicken egg issue for us. We have to have the carrier service in Portland in order for that company in Umatilla or Boise or Lewiston to get those cost advantages. Otherwise, they'll pay the cost to get it up through Seattle and Tacoma, where they'll catch the service to Asia from there. And so that's really the inland market that we're trying to capture. We have a value proposition to carriers that said, it basically says, this is your cargo market. They want to get particularly the exports out. Carriers are more focused on imports. It tends to be higher value cargo. And so we also have to have a value proposition to the ocean carriers that says, here's an import market that you can serve as well. Bring your ship here. And with the backhaul, you have all this export that wants to get back to Asia. Shift gears here, Westwood Shipping. I'm going to shift gears to two more recent business announcements that I think bode well for our future. One is the Westwood Shipping announcement. They will start service on July 11th. This is a monthly service to five ports in Japan, one in South Korea. We have really struggled to get a direct call to Japan. We have a lot of companies. Representative Smith's district wants to get to Japan, and we've struggled to have a container service direct from Portland to do that. K-Line has come and gone a few different times. They provided that direct link in the past. Westwood is going to come in and serve that need. That's going to bring more containers into the market, which has been in short supply, and it's going to supply this need for our shippers to get directly to Japan through Portland. It's an initial six-month agreement. It's got options to expand. I think we will expand this into a long-term agreement, but this is really a trial for this company to come into Portland. So I'm going to now talk about probably the bigger part of the news here. We entered into a recent 25-year lease with International Container Services. And so to start that discussion, I'm just going to give you a little more background on where we've been in looking at leasing our container facility. When you look up and down the west coast of the United States, you find that all other container ports have deployed the landlord operating model versus the Port Authority operating model. Portland is the last to do the Port Authority operating model. Why have they done that? All the other ports have found that engaging a partnership with a private operator who could be an ocean carrier company or could be just a general terminal operator who has market reach with other operations throughout the world is a better way to drive more business through the facility. And so we've been, since 2007, in the market looking to change our operating model. We have frankly struggled to keep carrier service. It's been a very volatile business for the port to operate. So we've been trying to figure out, is there a different operating model that will allow us to sustain and grow our business, to improve our financial performance, and frankly, to offload some of the capital risk onto this private partner. The recommendation that we took to our commission in late 2007, and they agreed to, was that we would enter into a global market solicitation for a long-term lease of Terminal 6. We spent all of 2008 in that process. We literally had more than 10 qualified operators that were interested in Portland. We learned a lot on how people view Portland relative to other ports, and we began to get to know ICTSI. During 2008, the market began, unfortunately for us, to really shake. And by late 2008, we suspended the global solicitation because the market had really essentially gone over a cliff, especially on containers. In 2009 and 10, ICTSI came back to the port and asked if we would be interested in having bilateral negotiations for a landlord lease. And so we've been doing that, and that culminated 2 weeks ago with a recommendation for a 25-year lease agreement with ICTSI that our commission agreed to. I'll talk a little bit more about them in the next few slides.
So we have a question. So Representative Shaw.
Thank you. You know, a couple years ago, there was some firm out of Dubai. It was going to run Baltimore's port. It blew up in the press and all that. And I think, obviously, the Philippines aren't Dubai. But can you just briefly explain to me why we can't find an operator that is an American operator to operate our port? I mean, I understand the need for a long-term lease because they have to get a return on their investment. But and I'm very ignorant about what you're doing. I don't have any idea what, you know, is good or bad, or, you know, how they, why they are better than everybody else that may have responded to your bid proposal. But there's no one in America that can operate these ports. There's no business in America that can do this.
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, there are American companies that responded in that 2008 process, none of which provided a compelling value proposition to the port.
Madam Chair, and I'll just shut up after that. I would like you to do one pager on what is a compelling value operation, or whatever it is you just said, and then we can just move on. But I want to know what's compelling and what isn't compelling.
Yeah, and so I'd say there's a financial component to that was very clear for us in the way we compared the proposals. But the other has to do with global market reach. This is very much a business that, by and large part, is foreign. There are more foreign operators of U.S. ports than there are U.S. operators of U.S. ports. When you look up and down the West Coast at all the landlord leases, it's roughly 65-70% are foreign lessees of those terminals. You know, why is that? Well, the business is a global business, and what you're looking for, I know what we were looking for, is a partner that has terminal operations around the globe who can increase our global reach, because as just a Port Authority in Portland, Oregon, We've struggled to do that.
Madam Chair, if I may briefly. Yes. You know, I hope in your, when you're examining these bids, you ask specifically, because this isn't the last contract the port's ever going to let out. I know you're in it for 25 years now. How they reimburse their workers, not just in America, but abroad, wages, benefits, pensions, working conditions, turnover, all those things. Because I think, and maybe it already is, and maybe you're going to tell me you already do, that should be calculated into every single bid for anything you contract out for any service at all.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, this operation will be an Oregon company. It's essentially an LLC of the parent company. The employees that run the port will be the same employees that run the port today. It's our labor. We will be reimbursed for those costs. The International Longshore Warehouseman Union will continue to operate the port as they do today. The employer, the management, will be this new company that was formed in Oregon, but it is backed. It is backed by the parent company, which happens to be in the Philippines.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
This slide here just shows the lease premises, and we're on, so we're looking down at Terminal 6 now. There are three berths, the yard area, the administration building, and the intermodal rail yard. What this lease does not include is the import Honda lease, which is a 60-acre parcel. And the AWC lease, which is a 120-acre parcel where we import Hyundai automobiles. So some background on ICTSI, International Container Services, Inc. They were founded in 1987, based in Manila. This is a publicly traded company. You can go to their website and get a wealth of information. They are the fourth largest independent operator in the world. They operate 18 terminals in 13 different countries. This slide just shows the global reach. This has been a growing company. They are primarily in the Asian area, but they're also, I think, notably for us, the North America, South America trade is an area that we've wanted to expand. And they're growing in that area, and I think that's an area where we'll be partnering with them to grow the business. In summary, we've certainly international service is critical to economic development and job growth in Oregon, and we believe these two announcements, both Westwood and ICTSI, is going to put us on a more stable footing for the container business to be able to grow that international service in the future. We know that Westwood is going to address more of a short-term need that we want to expand in the long-term, particularly for our ag exporters. The ICTSI lease, we're very excited about this. This is very much a partnership. This is not a situation where we're just turning the keys over to someone to operate our terminal. It's actually a business relationship. We actually continue to provide security. We continue to provide maintenance. We own the cranes. We get reimbursed by them for providing those services. But more importantly, the business deal that we entered into with ICTSI incents both parties to grow the volume over time, which is what I think we all really want, because it leads to jobs and it leads to stabilizing the service callings that we have through Portland that helps the rest of our exporters and importers grow. With that, I'm happy to answer any further questions.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Keith, it's good seeing you. And on behalf of the citizens of Eastern Oregon, we want you to know how much we appreciate you. We appreciate the Port of Portland. From our perspective, it ought to be called the Port of Oregon because there's not a county or a community or a household that doesn't benefit as a result of the Port of Portland and the work you do. So we appreciate you.
Thank you.
Really quick, I've got two thoughts, and I was hoping you could comment on them. One is if you could talk about the role that your upland river ports play in supporting the Port of Portland, primarily the Port of Morrow and the Port of Umatilla. And then second, and I know time's limited in this conversation that could take many, many hours, but if you could just dig a little deeper and talk about the international competition that the Port of Portland is facing in terms of our relationship with SeaTac, Port of Tacoma, up and down the West Coast and how important it is for the Port of Portland to have the support of the legislature and the support of citizens in maintaining our viability.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, yeah, thank you for those questions and the comments. The I would say the upriver port relationship is a longstanding, very, very good relationship. I think we have a unique container on barge system that is unique in the world, and certainly unique in the United States. That system, because of this notion of lack of service in Portland, has been challenged over the last several years. And again, we think we're putting the pieces in place for long-term growth in that relationship. But the container on barge system, which really allows for a lot of the export community located in Eastern Oregon, Eastern Washington, to access the river at the ports of Lewiston, at Umatilla, at Morrow, put their containers on the barge system, a much more efficient, energy-efficient transport and cost-efficient mode of transport to Portland for transport to the deep draft vessels out to markets. That's been a great system. That's one that we want to expand over time. And of course, we always work with the upriver ports on industrial land and on various job strategies. So that will continue. I'd say the issue for Portland in running a container port 105 miles up a river that's depth constrained, even though we are deepening the channel to 43 feet, is that most of the other ports have unlimited depth, so the larger ships can go there very easily. A lot of container carriers have proprietary leases, long-term leases, in Seattle and Tacoma, in Oakland, in LA Long Beach. So they're going to naturally send that cargo that wants to go maybe to the Midwest, and it could cost-effectively come through Portland, and we really want that cargo coming through Portland. They're going to send it somewhere else because they already have a lease with another port in another region. So that landlord model has really hurt us because we haven't been able to compete well against it. We're hoping that the new landlord model that we're deploying here is going to help us particularly compete for that, what we call the discretionary cargo that's destined for points in the Midwest, but and could cost effectively, because of our rail network, come into Portland, be put on a rail, and off to the Midwest. It could come through Portland. We need a really good private partner that can leverage their relationships with these container carriers to bring it here. Without that, frankly, we've struggled to compete against, particularly against Seattle and Tacoma.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to point out one more time that the entire state of Oregon is dependent upon the Port of Portland and its success, and we appreciate the work you do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Leavitt, as you know, we're in the process of putting together our statewide port plan. And just for the benefit of other committee members who aren't as involved in that process as I've been, I'm wondering if you can just characterize the port's role in helping shepherd that plan through the process.
Madam Chair, Representative Edwards, and I apologize that I have not personally been as involved in that plan. I'm aware of it. I'm kind of looking back at Annette Price back there, who I know has been very involved in the plan. But I believe we have had a lot of input, and as I keep talking, she'll come and bail me out.
I wish I had somebody like that around.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm State Affairs Manager for the Port of Portland, and Representative Edwards, to your question, the Port has been very involved. We are a believer in accountability. We are a believer in, as Representative Smith talked about, the ports working as one. We are not a large market, but we can be a strong market together. And so the Port has been involved since the inception. 2.5 years ago, at least. We now have a plan. We've been working with the department on that plan and look forward to maximizing its potential as we go forward, as a lot of the smaller parts work on strategic and business plans. The port, as Keith has mentioned, we have those things. We've had those things in place, but we are looking for a more cohesive and coherent future for all of the ports in Oregon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does this new landlord lease model offer some additional opportunities to some of the smaller ports along the coast?
Madam Chair, Representative Edwards, the landlord model is not new to ports. Mm-hmm. And in fact, all of our other marine terminals are under landlord leases. Mm-hmm. So the Toyota lease is a long-term lease for Toyota. And Representative Schaffler put it well, that length of term is what they need to be able to amortize their investment and see a return. And so we've got that, and a lot of the other ports deploy that model as appropriate, because typically ports don't want to sell particularly waterfront industrial land. That's land of state significance. It's land of regional and local significance. So we do deploy the long-term lease model typically throughout, and I believe other ports do as well.
Okay. One last question. In terms of port improvements for Terminal 6, are we on the hook for that, or is it in partnership with ICTSI?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Edwards, good question. And so we did, with this deal, shift most of the capital burden for improvements. We kept some. This is nearly a 40-year-old asset, and so we spent a lot of time with them going into excruciating levels of due diligence on the condition of the asset. There are certain areas of the facility that are really not up to snuff right now. The port is on the hook to bring it up to that baseline level, and then ICTSI will be responsible for paying for the cost of the maintenance from that point forward.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, briefly, ma'am. And thank you for coming, too, by the way. And don't think my pointed questions are anyway in opposition to what you're doing, and I wish you best of luck on your agreement with this operator. You talk about the challenge of going up river. I had the privilege to go to Shanghai a few years ago, and their port isn't deep enough for a lot of these ships, and they are building a bridge out to an island they purchased to make their deep water port. That bridge is going to include several highway lanes for freight and railroad. And it's 25 miles out in the ocean. Now, I'm sure they're pouring concrete there right now. And we're struggling here to replace an old bridge that's been around since 1915. And then there's people out there suggesting that people like Mike Schaffler and the building trades and the contractors and designers are somehow in the way of building a bridge. I just cannot emphasize that that's absurd enough. My question to you, though, is there's a lot of private export of grain out of the port of Portland. It isn't, I mean, not the the government port, out of our port up there. Container ships and grain carriers are two different ships. Be nice if some real smart person out there designed one that could do both. You could fill it up with grain, ship it over there, and come back a bunch of containers, and then you wouldn't have anybody deadheading, which I'm sure you don't in this freight industry. But it's just kind of, I wonder why somebody hasn't dreamed that up yet.
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, actually grain does go out in it's containerized now. It's not typical, and so you're correct also. The Port of Portland's grain, again, a landlord lease we have at Terminal 5 is with Columbia Grain. They're a private operator. They own that facility, and they export grain, even though they're exporting from our property. They're very much a private grain elevator, and there's a series of private investments up and down the river system all the way into the inland parts of the Pacific Northwest that are largely private owner and operated that create this great funnel of export. It's the economy of scale to ship in bulk versus containerized. It's a lot higher cost to ship container.
Representative Bone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can either or both of you address the security issues at the port? Do you inspect, for example, every container, and then do you have some sort of secondary level of, you know, we want to take a closer look at that one or something like that?
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, the first of all, I want to reinforce that under this lease of our container facility, the port will continue to be the security provider. on Terminal 6, and we will, again, be reimbursed for that service by ICTSI. Terminal 6 has a, there's a very strong federal presence on the terminal. Every container goes through scanning to be essentially screened, and then if necessary, pulled aside and checked, but not every single container, if it makes it through the scanning piece, gets pulled aside.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Did you? Do you have a question?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Betts.
Too many questions to select from, but I am curious, does the state, I don't know how to use this word correctly, but does it subsidize the port? Because I am interested in the nature of the lease and how one determines how far a partner has to go in contributing to whatever is done. And one of the questions came very close to that issue. But that weighing and balancing of the benefit we're generating by virtue of having a port on the one hand versus the cost that the rest of the state puts into it is of interest to me. So where might I see that analysis that I'm sure was done in determining how to draft the lease?
Very good question, Madam Chair, Representative Benz. So there is no direct subsidy from the state into the port. We like to talk about this is both I think a source of pride for the port, but also a challenge for us. 97% of all of our operating revenues comes from private sector transactions. So we do get a 3% subsidy. It's from the metropolitan area property tax base as a local government. There is no operating subsidy that comes from the state. Where you have made the investments is in the infrastructure, and it's been critically important. Channel deepening, I would put top on that list. And then the Connect Oregon investments, our most recent post-Panamax, kind of the most productive and efficient container crane out there in the world today. We purchased one of those cranes with the Connect Oregon investment, and which was part of the thinking for us in assuring that we retain the ownership of those cranes and that we maintain the cranes and get reimbursed under this lease. So we're protecting the state's asset that way. And beyond that, I'm sure there are some other infrastructure investments over the years that have happened at Terminal 6, but it's primarily in the area of transportation investments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the wrong type of question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, and that is that because of the complexity of what you have, one single thing is probably not going to lead to an immense increase in our business, but why don't you give me your best prioritization of what we might do to help generate more activity, if there is one thing?
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, so good question. I think we're, you know, we reached a reality in the current economic downturn, and this happened on the air side as much as it happened on the marine side. The marine business, we've been up and down this wave for several years now, and it's been part of this ongoing initiative to figure out a better way of operating. But the challenge of providing enough of a market-based value proposition to an international air carrier or marine carrier when we have a market that is really not very large from a consumer standpoint is a really big challenge. And we are competing against much larger regions who are able to make that pitch based on the market analysis, but they're also much higher publicly subsidized ports than we are. And so we ended up a year and a half or so ago with Delta essentially faced with losing our air connection to Europe, which also is the connection to Asia with Delta and Northwest. Where we had to just go ahead and provide a significant cash incentive to keep Delta in the market for the next year and a half. They're now kind of coming out of that tough period, and the news is great. They want to continue, and I think everything looks pretty good there. But it was a moment where we said, we need some partners to help us on this. And it's not just the Port of Portland that is gaining from keeping international service in the region. It's such an important statewide issue that we want to work on some legislative strategies for next session, frankly, to help us incentivize international carrier service.
Thank you.
Just very quickly, Keith, I want to follow up on some of your comments. You talked about the investment the state has made in basic infrastructure. But once again, I want to reiterate, channel deepening didn't just benefit the Port of Portland. That benefited the entire Columbia Snake River system, including all of rural eastern Oregon. And then on Connect Oregon investments, those were competitive grants that the Port of Portland wasn't handed to give me, but rather you folks had to compete through an application process, and your projects rose to the top.
Absolutely. And, you know, I would go as far on the channel deepening as to say, you know, based on the input we received from the kind of the global marketplace in 2008 about the Terminal 6 lease, without the prospect of the 43 feet, if we were just stuck at 40, we would have been talking to ourselves. There would not have been a conversation about a long-term lease.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Keep up the good work. Keep moving forward and make us all very happy and
we'll try.
Economically viable.
Thank you.
Right?
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to ask Doug Tindall to come forward. No. All the great things he's doing, right?
I did.
Good job.
Did you pass it?
I did.
Yes. I was going to write you a note.
Sorry, drop.
Congratulations.
Thanks, and good morning, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Doug Tindall, Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I can't take personal responsibility for this, but there are a number of great things going on. In fact, partially because of the hard work of the folks at ODOT, but also because of the hard work of the governor and the legislature and Congress. I'm here today to talk about transportation investments across Oregon, mostly this summer. And it is good news. Because of the investments that we have in our ongoing funding, the traditional methods of funding, and the Oregon Transportation Investment Acts, 1, 2, and 3 that were passed by the legislative body, and the Jobs and Transportation Act passed most recently by the legislative body, and stimulus funds that came from the federal government, we are positioned in contracting and highway projects to spend about $1.1 billion this calendar year. And importantly, what that translates to is two things. First off, it translates to improvements to the state highway system and to the bridges, and assurance that for a bit longer we'll be able to keep freight and people moving. And secondly, it creates about 12,500 jobs, or it sustains about 12,500 jobs. Again, I think the best way to look at this is there are 12,500 Oregonians working on highway projects across the state this year that otherwise, but for those investments, that you have been in part of, would not be or may not be working this year. The construction business, as I'm sure Representative Schaffler is aware, is down, has been down, and continues to be down, and this is, in fact, keeping people at work. So, good news, and thank you on behalf of Oregon, and thank you. Let me talk just briefly about the Jobs and Transportation Act. That had a number of projects specifically named in that act, and I provided an update on some of the ones that are already going on this year or already completed this year. As you know, some of those projects are longer-term projects where more design or in some cases environmental work needs to be done. We are working on all of those projects. The ones I've listed here are just the ones that are either already completed in one case or will be under construction this summer and providing jobs. In addition, the OTIAs Investments are...
Pardon me to interrupt you. Representative Edwards has a question.
Oh, sorry.
Hey, Mr. Tindall.
Hi.
I just wanted to ask quickly about the policy regarding projects that come in under the expected cost. So it's my understanding that, for instance, the U.S. Highway 26 widening from 185th to Cornell has come in at $10 million under what we anticipated.
Yes.
So I expect that that money would go back to the OTC for reallocation?
Chair Beyer, Representative Edwards, no. DOJ advises us that those amounts that are specified in the Jobs and Transportation Act for the specific projects are can only be spent on those projects, and the only way to change that is to, by legislative action.
Okay. So follow up. So this means that in the next session we'll need to get an accounting then of the monies that are expected to be spent in accordance with the projects we laid out in the JTA and then make adjustments?
Chair Beyer, Representative Edwards, that's most likely. I can tell you what happened on the OTIA 3 where we had not specific, well, we knew what the specific bridges were, the 365 of them, and what we found is on any individual project, you may have an additional cost or you may have a lesser cost. So the legislature will need to continue to be informed on what the most current estimates for those projects are. The difficulty, excuse me, in some of those projects is that they are still a ways out. And until you actually let the contract, you're really never sure what the cost is going to be. So that will be a challenge that you'll have to struggle with.
Okay.
Follow up.
Do you have a recommended process then to ensure that we're timely enough or we're not issuing bonding authority unnecessarily to accommodate projects that are coming in under cost, or alternately that we're not kind of holding up money that could be spent on other projects?
Chair Beyer, Representative Edwards, I think we need to get closer to January of 2011 to see where we are so that we can couch that in terms of risk-based, what is the chances that some of these projects are going to cost more? What do we believe the chances are that they're going to cost less before we can figure that out? In terms of the specific bonding, though, be assured that our bonding strategy is based around a cash management. We didn't, just because you set aside those amounts of money didn't mean we sold the bonds immediately. So we're not going to have bond revenue sitting around, if you will.
Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. Highway 26 runs through the densest population in the state, goes right through my district, and the streets are unimproved. There's potholes. It's just a gravel side. There's children walking down that street going to school, senior citizens trying to get to and from A and B. You know, I take some of that money that you're saving, figure out how much it's going to cost to put some sidewalks and curbs on that stretch of the highway, and then go do it. And that would make our community a lot safer. I highly encourage you examine that specific part of the highway to improve. Thank you.
Okay.
As I said, the Oregon Transportation Improvement or Investment Act, OTIAs 1, 2, and 3 are largely winding down. In fact, the last bundle of bridges from OTIA 3 will go to contract this summer. And we are on target to complete, actually, maybe 1 year early. When we passed that bill in 2003, we said 10 years was a reasonable amount of time to get those bridges done. And the last bridge that we'll complete, I believe, is the Willamette River Bridge in Eugene. And because of some innovative contracting, that may make it even earlier than 2013. There's a couple other bridges that are going to be close to that, though. But for a large part, the investment, again, that the legislature and the governor passed was spent, and spent wisely and spent quickly and put people to work. The ARRA funds, American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, those are the federal stimulus funds. Those are about a little bit more than half of the money was spent last year, and the rest of it will, on the highway projects, will be spent this year. And so all of those investments in total, again, are providing jobs for Oregonians throughout, needed jobs, and particularly in this economy, throughout this year. In addition to that, Connect Oregon, and we have three versions of Connect Oregon now, the first of which has largely been completed, the second of which is about halfway through or is underway in halfway, and the third where the projects will be selected this biennium. We look at jobs there slightly differently because part of the selection criteria for those projects is how many jobs are going to be created. Permanent jobs are going to be sustained or created. And so in those, we see a large number of jobs, not so much on the project itself, but as a result of the project. And those are longer-term jobs, are ones that are expected to continue well past the completion of the project. So, again, I believe, at least in my mind, it's a good news story that we are... And thank you on behalf of ODOT, and again, thank you on behalf of Oregon for the investments and the decisions that you made that allowed us to get this construction underway and put these people to work. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
I'm going to share one more thing. It's a nice thing. Mr. Tyndall's leaving us and retiring. He's going to go fish and drink beer and hopefully invite me. But I just wanted to thank you for your service to the state.
Thank you.
And putting up with people like me for so long.
I've said, Chair Beyer, as I've, and for all of the committee, as I've gone around and talked to people, you get a different perspective when you decide to retire and move on to do something else. And the folks that dedicate a lot of their life, you know, I just, compatriot employees in ODOT, I just think are the best. But I also recognize the people that serve on boards and commissions, and the people that serve in elected offices. For what you people paid, you do a tremendous service to Oregon. So my thanks to you all as well.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to echo Representative Schaffler's comments. Doug, you've just done a fabulous job for the state of Oregon, and appreciate all you do, and appreciate all you do for Eastern Oregon and for the whole state. You've always been a straight shooter. You've always been willing to come and share with us what you can and can't do, and appreciate your leadership.
Thank you.
So, you want to move to your next presentation?
Sure. Oh, I thought he was done. I was going to get the cake
one
out.
More.
That's why I was holding mine.
Oh, okay.
Well, now we're just going to beat the crap out of him.
Yeah. That was part B.
Hopefully, Ms. Price is still in the audience and can come bail me out if I get stuck. The second item that I have for you today is on the federal flexible funds. In the Jobs and Transportation Act, there was a provision giving ODOT, giving the Oregon Transportation Commission $24 million a year so that we could maintain the commitments that we have on the highway projects and make available funds that there's in the federal world, there's a type of funds that are referred to as flexible. Now, they're not infinitely flexible, but they're slightly more flexible than other types of federal funds in that they can be spent largely on transit, but also on bike paths and trails. So it's options for people to be able to move. So what I've got here is the commission just gaveled down on the federal flexible funds and how they're going to be allocated, and so I'm going to describe that to you today. It's in these PowerPoints. I never use computers at this table because of I'm technically inept, apparently. Something always goes wrong, so if you'll just, I'll just take you through this handout. So the overview I pretty much gave you, I think the thing that's important to note here is the commission wanted a well-vetted, inclusive process to talk about how we can allocate the monies that are now available because of the actions in the JTA. And if you now on page 3, I talked about these flexible funds being more flexible than just being used on highway, but you can see in that list the things that are eligible. And I think a couple of things to note, as I said, the bicycle and pedestrian projects, the transit projects, and importantly, transportation planning and research, which is going to be useful in meeting the requirements of some of the other aspects of House Bill 2001 and House Bill 2186, and then Senate Bill 1059 from the most recent interim session, where there were requirements to do transportation planning that cross into the land use area pretty significantly, and these are the types of funds that are available for that. I want to make one note that's an important note, I believe. When the stimulus funds came out, there was a competition directed by the Oregon Transportation Commission, and there were rail projects and port projects and transit operating expenditures. Those were eligible under those stimulus dollars. They are not eligible for STP funding, so there is a little bit of a difference. And there's one other caveat. About $15.5 million a year of these federal flexible funds come in a particular, what we refer to as color, and that is the congestion mitigation air quality, or CMAQ funds. And those can only be used in non-attainment areas in Oregon. And there's, I believe, seven non-attainment areas in Oregon. So those are flexible, but limited to those particular non-air quality attainment areas. So on page four, we get about, it really page four describes the chart on page five. We get around 100, just slightly over $100 million a year in STP funds. There is a federal requirement to pass through monies to transportation management areas. Those are the largest of the metropolitan planning organizations, Portland, Salem, and Eugene. We have no discretion there. That goes right through. So you end up with around $80 million, $75 to $80 million, depending on the year, of money that's available within ODOT. There was a lot of discussion in the during the session, during the 2009 session, about making sure that 10% of the flexible funds was made available for elderly and disabled transportation. The commission asked us to calculate that. There was no discussion at the time that I recall about where to calculate that 10%, because you could do it virtually anywhere on this chart. The commission asked that we calculate that as high as we could, which means 10% of the money that's available to the state, and so that's what's done here and shown on the first line. Actual legislatively adopted budget put a little bit more than that into the elderly and disabled transportation, and that's what's shown on the second line under legislative intent. And then our estimates, sorry.
So I just want to understand when you're saying that you're taking the 10% at the highest point. Mm-hmm. So is that to say that it would be unlawful for us to have taken 10% of the $101 million and then subtract the $24 million mandated by the federal government to be passed through from that lesser amount?
Chair Beyer, Representative Call, no, there's nothing illegal about that. It was
a
choice.
We could have taken 10% from the $100 million.
That's correct. And when we explained that to the commission, they said take 10% of what the state has control over. But you can, I mean, the 10% was a number, was a percentage that was discussed. There's no magic about it. The legislature can direct whatever they want to direct, because that's an eligible use of these STP funds.
Yeah, I just, Madam Chair, if I'm right, I just remember that, you know, there was a lot of discussion around this, and then a letter was sent, a letter I didn't sign on to, so this isn't me. I think maybe I wasn't even asked to sign on to it, for better or for worse, but, you know, signed by a bunch of members of this committee, bipartisan, and I have it in front of me, and it talked about that the idea was that it would be taken, the 10% would be taken from the total of available flexible funds before other distributions have been made. And to me, that seems to say, and this letter signed by the Speaker of the House, President of the Senate, Representatives Berger, Beyer, Vince, that seems to me to mean that, you know, before any other distributions, that the intent of this committee and the people who are in this room negotiating this transportation package, that the money would be taken right off the top before any distributions were made. And I'm just wondering if it was a lack of clarity on our part that has, you know, to my way of viewing the world, taken about $3 million from senior and elderly transportation.
Chair Beyer, Representative Call, I think the question is, before any other distributions are made, and by whom is making them, because the federal government makes the first distribution. But I think that that's I don't know that that's material to the discussion, because if you look at what's actually in the budget, you are very close to that 10%. I mean, you're just slightly under 10% of the total. In other words, I think possibly what you're saying was indeed endorsed by the actual budget that was passed by the legislature, where they did take the 10% of the larger number. That's what's in the budget.
Okay.
Representative Shoffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, all this planning, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail. And I've built a lot of stuff, and you got to plan, you got to build to that plan specifically, accurately, every time. But don't anybody fall out of their chair here, but I have to share the concerns that were just shared with you by Representative Call. I have a lot of seniors and disabled folks in my district too, and I met with TriMet representatives last week, and they really wanted me to stress the importance of using as much of this money as we can, providing that transportation to those folks. TriMet had to cut the line that goes through the Valley Bowl and Happy Valley due to lack of ridership. But the folks that were using that need it the most. And so I just want to share my concern there, and I hope we get as much as we can to continue to provide those services. And, you know, Portland isn't the only area, obviously, that's struggling with funding these services either, but I just wanted to chime in on that. Thank you.
Thanks, Representative Beyer and Representative Shoffler. I think possibly not actually listed in here, the direction from the commission as you walk down this chart and you get down to the part that's OTC directed, the commission's direction to the committee that I'm going to discuss in a minute was to that, you know, commitments are made for fiscal years 10 and 11, and the budget is what the budget is. But past that, where this chart continues to show allocations to a number of things that the commission has already directed, the commission said is going to tell the committee to step back and look at those allocations and say, are those indeed the right allocations, or should we be looking at reshuffling the existing allocations to free up more money for particular uses? Certainly, I think the commission appreciates, as the department appreciates, the need for elderly and disabled transit and the growing need. In fact, as you have a greater elderly population. Okay. So the summary, two things I want to call your attention to, one I just did, and this chart and the amount of money that's going to be available is greater past 2012 because of what's in the current budget. But for this biennium, there remains about $21 million that is not flexed, it has not been allocated yet. And again, Representative Shoffler, there is still more money available. And through this competitive process that the commission has laid out, those kinds of things will play and certainly be considered. So on page 6, the OTC guidance, as I said, competitive process. The governmental entities, this doesn't mean that it can only be spent by governmental entities. It means that the whatever money flows out has to flow through a governmental entity. They can hire a private contractor. This is a nuance from, it just says that you can't have a private bus service, for instance, come in. They have to come in with a city or with a transit district. Again, the eligible uses. They ask that the committee consider project readiness, because we have to obligate these monies by September of 2011, that there be some geographic equity. And let me stress here that the discussion at the commission was not geographic equity necessarily in the sense of dollars, but geographic equity in the sense of projects. The commission observed that there are opportunities in more rural parts of Oregon to do a lot with a little bit of money. And So we want to make sure that there's projects across the state, and we want to make sure that the projects are effective and that the money matches the need for the project. The project size bullet, just a suggestion that we want something meaningful to be done. We want sort of a minimum project size. The committee will recommend what that project size might be, and similarly a maximum project size. in terms of not having one project take up all the money. And then I think really critically, and much stressed by the commission, is kind of a challenge. It's going to take a while to the existing uses, as well as these new uses, to come up with measures of program effectiveness. How can we tell what the outcomes of our investments are? And that, I think, is an important thing to start looking at. That's not one that I think the committee is going to make recommendations, but that's going to take a while to ferret all of that out. The committee membership's on page 7. The chair is a OTC member, Commissioner Olson, and then there's a wide, as you can see, a wide variety of folks. Just would note at the very bottom, there's a safety representative. That's there because we currently fund, work zone enforcement, work zone police patrols with these STP funds because we can't fund enforcement with state highway funds, and we wanted to make sure that they were there, that safety was represented, to talk about that current allocation and the outcomes that we see from that allocation. And finally, on the last page, the timeline, an aggressive timeline that winds up with a project list in January of next year. For the, and I should note that this is the project list for the 2010-11 time frame, and probably additional or another process for years out after that. So that's where the department is in terms of the flexible funding. I appreciate Representative Call's comments. You know, and it's without a specific clarity, it wasn't. It truly. We didn't intend to subvert the intent of the legislature in any way. We just didn't feel we had that money. But on the other hand, as I said, I think that was a number that was discussed. And in fact, when you see what actually came out in the budget, the money's in there.
Madam Chair. And just thank you, Madam Chair. If I guess, you know, some of this for me is informed by spending a significant amount of time working on an MPO task force where we had folks from all throughout the state, Southern Oregon, Eastern Oregon, local government officials. And one of the things that came of that process, I think the one thing that there was absolute unanimity around was that we needed more and dedicated state funding for transit. And when you look around at the pots of money that are out there in the transportation budgets, where we can actually marshal enough resources together to make a significant difference and a significant impact, not just in Portland and not just with senior and disabled services, but actually throughout our state, communities like Rogue Valley, Deschutes County, the county we're in right now, Representative Burgers County, where the real opportunity to make a difference in transit and use and marshal those state dollars, those dollars that are there. One of the few places we can look is this federal, are these federal flexible funds, and so what I wanted to make sure was happening here was that we weren't seeing a downplaying of the legislative intent to start to move forward towards a realization that these funds have to be freed up and have to be made available for this. For this purpose, and that moving forward, we're going to, you know, it's my objective to try to free more of these funds up to try to help communities throughout the state that desperately want transit funding and have no capacity to raise it on their own. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And while I agree with almost everything he said here, I will say that I do think that we aren't funding transit or special needs transit or alternative modes enough in the state, and we have some limitations on how we do it that we're going to have to start looking at. But I do think that a lot of the planning dollars, because that's really the other piece of it, you know, it's either transit or it's planning, and we have to do both, obviously. And so we have to have a balance in how we spend the dollars. But with that, I want to say thank you for all you've done for the state and for helping us do our work here in the House. I was early in my career when you stepped into this position. I did not expect to be here when you stepped out of this position, though. And I know that ODOT is quite capable and has a lot of great people on staff, and they'll do a good job when you leave, but you are going to definitely be missed by all of us who've worked with you and the citizens.
Thank you, Chair Byer.
Thank you. So with that, Cheryl Gribska.
Thank you, Representative Byer and members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Gribska. I'm the CEO of the Oregon Travel Information Council, and I'm here to give you an update on Section 32 and 33 of the Transportation Act, specifically our management takeover on January 1 of the five rest areas. Actually, we call them nine rest areas because we separate each one out on I-5 and I-84 for north and south based on our agendas. When you passed the bill and we began to act, we developed an implementation plan with the specific goal of making sure that we covered all of the wishes of the subcommittee who gave us this opportunity. And so we did two specific trips out into each rest area. We walked with the current ODOT maintenance people. We learned about each rest area and got a unique view of what it needed and what we were going to need to do to plan and inventory. And once those priorities were set and we knew what kind of people we needed to work out there, we began our recruitment in September, and we were lucky to find some people who had facilities experience who were unemployed or underemployed in the areas where we had rest areas. So we were able to hire 64% of everyone we hired for this job were unemployed or underemployed, meaning that they had three seasonal jobs trying to keep the income coming in so that they were able to support their families. We also have 67 local businesses on target working for us. They're either doing maintenance, they're doing landscaping, or there are electrical people or plumbing experts, whatever else we need out there. So we wanted local businesses to really benefit from this particular piece of the legislation. We're really proud of the fact that we were able to do that. We started on January the 1st with an agreement with ODOT that we were responsible for everything from the ingress to the egress of that rest area, meaning that we were responsible for the buildings, we were responsible for the trees that may need to be removed, and so we got an arborist to identify those, and we were responsible for any of the paving of the sidewalks or the parking lot. In the 5 months that we've been doing this, we've had some great wins. I can honestly say that the focus has been on repairing some of the equipment in the bathrooms, making sure that we had maintenance people that were trained and motivated to keep the bathrooms clean and safe to the motoring public. We have found great opportunities. For example, at the Ball Dock rest areas that are just south of Wilsonville, the local dahlia farm has partnered with our managers, and they're putting in some dahlia beds to showcase local products. And we're going to do more flower beds in all the rest areas to show what we have to offer so that the visitor may even go to that dahlia farm as they see that. They found a pond that was filled with debris and other kind of brush. They got that cleaned out. They've installed turtles and mosquito-eating fish. And so now people can go back there. They can have a picnic lunch, and they can look at this beautiful pond in the southbound section of the Ball Docks. And we have juvenile corrections crews that are helping us get down the invasive foliage and down to brush in the forested areas. Probably nothing looks better than the Ontario rest area. Those folk out there have removed scores of overgrown hawthorn bushes and lilac brushes, bushes, excuse me, so there's better motorist visibility, and it's just gorgeous. There is one section of that rest area that has an old freight wagon in it, and nobody knew it because the rabbit brush had grown so tall that it just looked like a lot of rabbit brush. And what they've been able to do is remove most of that, landscape it, and I saw more people having their pictures taken next to that freight wagon after they left the restrooms and they got their visitor information at the Welcome Center. I went into the restroom last week, and I was stunned at how beautiful it was, and I also was thrilled when a woman who was in there with me said she'd just traveled across the country and they were the cleanest restrooms she'd seen on the trip. So I bragged about that a lot all the way back to Salem. In Boardman, we've been able to refurbish our water lines for potable water and sprinkling systems. They've painted all the picnic tables and they've installed two dog stations. We found in the Sandy M rest area, which is just north of Albany, that there was dumping that was occurring right next to the river, at the Sandy M River, about 30 yards, right next to the designated salmon estuary. So we put a big gate and stopped the dumping, cleaned out the material, and everything has been disposed, and now it's being used by the boaters for picnicking. What we've found mostly is that having on-site people 7 days a week has really helped the motorists with safety issues and just basic services. In Ontario, a woman's car wouldn't start. The manager drove home, got everything he needed to start her car, went back, and she was on the road in 20 minutes. We had a severe accident outside of Grants Pass, and our on-site managers were the first on the scene and made sure that all the emergency people were there to take care of that. We have had one fax machine left on a picnic table at Boardman, and when the manager watched it for a great deal of time and found that there was somebody staring at it from a car, and when she went over to the car to find out why he was sitting there staring at it, after an hour, he drove away at breakneck speed. Made her nervous. She called the state police, and there was ample indication that that might have been a dangerous fax machine for however it was rigged, and they pulled in their robot and they got it dismantled. So what we're finding more and more is that people are very appreciative of the fact that there's eyes and ears there all the time and taking care of business. We also want to upgrade our coffee service people so that there's more folk in great buildings serving coffee with Q training from Travel Oregon, so they have customer service. We'll direct people into the local areas, but we'll also provide more on-site presence in the rest areas. Since January 1, we have formed coalitions in three rest areas. That's North and South Baldock and the Boardman rest area. Those coalitions are made up of legislators, county commissioners, mayors of cities, travel people that have visitor bureaus, chambers of commerce, and they all sit down and set a long-range vision. We've come a long way on the Wilsonville rest areas. We have subcommittees that are working on funding for those kinds of activities they'd like to see happen that can't be funded by highway funds, and we have other projects that they're working on right now. We have two coalitions that are being set up for the Sandy M rest area, which is outside of Albany and also Ontario. One of the most significant experiences since January 1 was the identification of 35 people that were living in the Baldock rest areas, both north and south, outside of Wilsonville. They'd been there for over 15 years and had become very close and quite a neighborhood, and really weren't eager to meet us. They thought we would be kicking them out soon, and it was clear that we needed to come up with a plan that would be a higher lifestyle for them, and yet we needed to not have all those rigs and vans and cars in the back parking lots where there was a significant amount of alcohol and drugs. So we convened a group of people that were the Oregon State Police, the Clackamas County Sheriff, social services from Clackamas County, as well as the state of Oregon, and a woman from the Canby Center, which formed 2 years ago. It's a faith-based organization that helps all families in the Canby School District and the Clackamas County DA. And collectively, we came up with a plan that we would find a way to have a new life for each of these people by April 30th, and then on May 1, we would find a way to not allow more people to move in. And ODOT stepped up to the table with temporary rules that we were able to use, so we presented those to the homeless and told them that they would not be able to smoke next to the rest areas. They were not going to be able to use the rest areas to bathe and take care of their laundry, and that they were not allowed to stay there more than 12 hours. When we started enforcing that, that meant that they would have to move some of those rigs into somewhere else, and they didn't have rigs that could move to somewhere else. So it was not a fun time for us, but with the social services on hand to do the intakes and to find what we needed to do for each of those people individually and uniquely, we were able literally to find homes for half of them before April 30th. The rest of them moved to parks and are still going through detox and intakes so that they can qualify for Section 8 housing, and they say that within 3 to 6 months they will all be housed. In the meantime, the snowbird homeless who fully plan to come in, it's kind of a Yuma situation. Evidently, the folk that have been there for all those years can't wait for the snowbirds to come in, because then it becomes more of an RV park setting with a lot of socialization that takes place. Sure. They know that they can't stay, and our managers make sure that they're notified of all the rules. They get a copy, each and every one. And if they're caught doing any kind of violations, the state police are there to help us to move them out. ODOT is working with us on some more stringent rules that will go through the vetting process, and we plan to see those in place in September so that people, when they're going into the rest areas, aren't having a panhandler talk to them, and sometimes even panhandlers that were in competition with the panhandlers at the front would wait for them inside the restroom to ask them for money. So it wasn't a safe feeling, and I think that we are 75% done in getting that resolved. So we're really grateful to ODOT because they have been at our side, especially Lucy Moore with maintenance operations. We have found that the Transportation Commission and the Travel Information Council have more and more discussions on how we can support each other. We have a lot of ideas on what's going to happen, and we're thrilled to have so many people from the local communities working with us on those ideas so that we really are serving them and not ourselves. And so that's what we've done since January.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank
Representative
you.
Shoffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, thank you for your work you're doing. I've seen the difference. I use that restaurant on the way home.
Good.
And I live in Clackamas County, and I think it should be a multi-county approach to that problem, specifically that rest stop, but I'm sure it's not unique. And as long as we're cavalier about running off private investment for LNG, power lines, timber, water development in this state, we're going to continue to have 250,000 Oregonians without a job and 1 in 5 on food stamps. It is just criminal, and that's where the money comes from, to put those good folks that are down on their luck in houses. And I understand there was a school bus picking children up at a rest stop because their parents don't have anywhere to house them. It's obscene what's going on in this state, and I'm hoping we have some change we can believe in next year in this building. My question, though, is why are the rules temporary when they're being so effective?
We had to get them fast. In order to meet the goals that we had, we had to get them fast, and a temporary rule can go through the system a lot faster than a permanent rule. They'll become permanent in September, October, but okay. In order for us to motivate them to move, yes. To go into social services, thank we you. Needed to do that.
Thank you very yes. much.
Representative Berger.
Thank you. Carol, thank you for the work that you're engaged in. It is a fact that you have a captive constituency. I traveled throughout California, Northern California, for a week this month. Mm-hmm. And when you need a rest area, you need a rest area, and you don't say, oh, well, this one doesn't have a clean bathroom, this one doesn't have coffee. You say, oh, my God, rest area, 3 miles. So I guess ultimately, what we're really about here is not restrooms, but encouraging economic development within our state by making our state welcome. And so what I would encourage you and the folks that you're working with, once you start to get your handle, and clearly you've done a marvelous job of getting your arm around just the physical aspects of this, is to start looking at some sort of a matrix that you can come back to me and say, as a result of this, this mm-hmm. happened. And as a result of our having improved this, this mm-hmm. positive thing happened. Of course, everything in this building is tied to a job, but jobs come as a result of economic activity that's positive and useful. So I think that ultimately that's what I would like to see into the future as a result, because we can have ODOT people go out and clean the restrooms, and they'll do a good job in their own way, but it won't be, their focus will not be on visitors, and that was the idea.
Right.
So since we have a different sort of outcome that we're engaged in here, I would really like to see you help develop how we can measure that, because in the coming years, bienniums, measuring outcomes is going to be more and more important.
Yes. Representative Beyer, Representative Berger, absolutely. And the reason that we have these coalitions is because the economic development is such a high focus for us. I like the idea of developing measures. I think that that's a great place to start with the coalitions, and we'll take that. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Cheryl, I wanted to thank you for the work in Ontario. We really appreciate it. By some odd stroke of coincidence, since we're an hour ahead of you in just 20 minutes, the folks are going to be presenting the rest area to the Ontario Chamber of Commerce as kind of an explanation of what's been done. So that's it's a very timely presentation. Mm-hmm. But I want to build just a little on Representative Berger's remark about the matrix, because we would welcome that type mm-hmm. of look in Ontario to see what indeed happens as a result of that improvement. We are having quite a challenge in people leaving Ontario and moving into Idaho mm-hmm. For various reasons. Many of them are doctors. And anything we can do to improve the Oregon side of that area is welcome. And this is huge for us. So I thank you for all your efforts.
Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to piggyback on what Representative Berger was saying. And you obviously have a successful model, and if you could at least be available for consultation with other areas and helping people get on back on their feet, and you did it in a manner in which they received what they needed and to move on. Because I've used that one rest area too in Wilsonville and seen the school bus stop there, and I thought, this means it's a little more permanent than just stopping through. Yeah. So if you have any way to do that and make a how-to model that could be applied to different applications, you know, or different circumstances, but might still be just as successful, I think that would be great.
Representative Beyer, Representative Boone, we are, the team that put this together, are developing that model for national distribution, and we're presenting it to the Safety Rest Area Association in September. I will say that in Albany, we have identified a group called Helping Hands that is a shelter for the homeless, but the idea is finding them a place to feel that they have more worth. And so they'll be joining us out in the Santa Ym rest areas and helping us with some of the labor out there. And I'm hoping that each rest area is going to have some stories like that.
That's great. Thank you. Any other questions?
Well, and thank you. I appreciate your coming and the update. I've been finding it fascinating to listen to what's been going on. And I will say, as we were putting the package together, that this was kind of a little bit of a sidebar almost that, you know, nobody really thought much about. But, you know, okay, we can try it and see how it works. And I just think it's been a star. And I, you know, hopefully we can expand this further as we go forward. And thank you so much for your success.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. So our next... Okay. Well, we'll take 5 minutes if you need break or something. And... let the next presenter get set up.
We'll load his, and then we'll load hers.
We're going to come back to order, and we have in front of us David Mayfield with the E-Tech, and he's updated his presentation and ready to go. So,
Madam Chair Beyer and committee, thank you for having me here. My name is David Mayfield. And since the publication of the agenda, our name has changed from E-Tech to Ecotality North America. We've taken on the name of our parent company. And so that there'll be a little bit of a transition period. If you still hear E-Tech out there, that's us. So thank you very much. I'm going to be presenting on the EV project, which is the largest rollout of infrastructure in the world, of electric vehicle infrastructure in the world. I'm also just going to provide a little bit of context relative to electric vehicles. So, benefits of electric vehicles. Very important for us relative to coping with climate change because of the zero emission vehicles or low emission vehicles that are produced. But there are other air quality benefits as well. For example, in Rogue Valley, which has particulate matter difficulties, electric vehicles in the fleet will substantially help them in meeting their air quality objectives. Electric vehicles will also help with reducing our reliance on foreign oil. One thing that's really important is that the battery storage in electric vehicles will have an influence, or hopefully have an influence, on how the electric grid functions and may be able to assist in providing us with some smart grid options for balancing our electric load. Also, electric vehicles here in Oregon will help us with our job market, in green sustainable jobs. So, relative to the greenhouse gas reduction and the importance of electric vehicles, I just wanted to share a slide with you that is part of the ODOT's Green Step modeling efforts. And what Green Step is doing is they're running scenarios to look at how we are going to meet our state obligations relative to greenhouse gas reduction. So the blue area on this slide represents the statewide goals as legislated. And the trend lines there indicate scenario building undertaken under Green Step in order to reach the goals in the blue zone. You can see that as of 2020, in this particular scenario, that none of the scenarios that were run meet the goals. But this is, in fact, assuming some very high usage of electric vehicles and other alternative fuel vehicles. So, for example, 50% of the auto sales assumed in year 2040 in this diagram are assumed to be electric vehicles. So in order to really meet our policy objectives relative to greenhouse goals, electric vehicles plays a very important role. I mentioned earlier about the smart grid and use of electric vehicles. The importance here is that reliability of the grid, as we're adding more air and more wind and solar, those are kind of transitory events. How do you store that? Well, a fleet of batteries out there in individuals' garages is one way to capture and store that energy when it's cheap. So supporting ways that the electric vehicles can help improve our electric grid is also very valuable. Our electric vehicle chargers that Ecotality North America sell have smart metering options, which allows for this kind of smart grid activity to be undertaken. By using the smart grid techniques, we can save up to 60 to 70% of the required grid infrastructure investment just by using smart charging techniques. That is to say that we can deploy all these electric vehicles and save 60 to 70% of the required investment. Just, are they coming? Yes, they're coming. Here's a few of the pure electric vehicles that will be showing up in the United States in the next couple of years. The Nissan Leaf being a partner with Ecotality Northwest in the electric vehicle project, which I'll be, the EV project, which I'll be explaining right now. We are a $200 million project. The contract is between ETEC and the U.S. Department of Energy. The purpose of this project is to build and study mature electric vehicle charging infrastructure in five regions, and that would include the pretty much the West Coast plus Tennessee. The importance here is to develop lessons learned about charging behavior. We are by a mature infrastructure. This is not just market driven. It's not just a few people putting out charging stations as there are a few electric vehicles purchased. This is us pushing out 1,000 public charging stations from Eugene north to Portland in Oregon, and to make those available so that we really understand behavior wise where people want to be charging. So we produce lessons learned that's good for the automobile manufacturers, the battery manufacturers, and the people like Ecotality North America that are locating charging stations. Nationwide, we're deploying 4,700 of these Nissan Leafs and 11,210 charging stations. In Oregon, Ecotality North America is investing $16 to $20 million. Oops, going backwards. So, pie chart here. Publicly available charging stations, 1,000. That left side of the pie chart, that represents charging stations that we're hoping to place primarily on private property, and for that to be publicly available, for example, at shopping centers, bistros, movie theaters, any place where people tend to gather. On the right, the next big chunk is home-based charging units. 900 charging stations will be available free with purchase of a Nissan Leaf. Then we also have some that will be available in public right-of-way, and also we have 45 of what's called fast chargers, which are extremely fast ways of charging these electric vehicles. We're working very closely with ODOT to place these units statewide in the most judicious and cost-effective way to provide a valuable network for a safety net for electric vehicle users. Speaking of ODOT, ODOT has convened for us an Oregon advisory team. Art James is the leader of that team, and it includes five cities, plus a number of departments in the state of Oregon. The OTREC, which is a research and education consortium that is multi-university, and Portland State University. Oh, excuse me, that should say University of Oregon. So, and we also have a number of utilities that are involved because, of course, the power needs to come from the utilities and the grid needs to be prepared for the project. There will be, as I said, 1,000 Nissan Leafs. Approximately 3/4 of them are likely to go to homeowners or private people or businesses that want to purchase 1, 2, or 3 Nissan Leafs. And fleet applications may be up to 1/3 of that 900. We're looking for people that are driving fairly long distances, that is about 800 miles per month. The reason being that we want to collect that data on the charging behavior. So we're out for science here. To participate, we also need people who are willing to have their data gathered. So that is one requirement of them getting a free charger. Most of the chargers that will be located are what are called level 2 or opportunity chargers. And these are, about like the voltage that you're going to see in an air powering an air conditioner or a dryer in your garage. And so they're a 40-amp, 240-volt, and they will be able to charge this rather sophisticated Nissan Leaf, which has a 100-mile range, in about 4 to 6 hours. There will be a lot of plug-in hybrid vehicles out there as well that will be able to use charging stations, and they will have smaller batteries and will be able to charge at a much quicker rate than the Nissan Leaf. So most of the charging activity, 80% or so, is going to occur in people's garage or at the home base, probably in the middle of the night. We're also planning on putting the publicly available stations in shopping centers. There will be curbside units available and wall-mounted units in parking garages. Something I want to mention about this level 2 charger, something really important. That thing on the left, that little handle, is called a J1772 compliant plug. It wasn't until this year that nationally we had a standard that allowed all the automobile manufacturers to take advantage of a standard and to make the rollout of electric vehicles less confusing. Unfortunately, what I'm about to show you right here, the level 3 plug, the fast charging plug, is not yet, we do not have a national standard yet. Nissan will be using a Japanese standard, and we'll be deploying a Japanese standard here in Oregon.
We have a couple of questions.
Yes.
Representative Berger.
Could you go back one slide? How long does it take to charge a vehicle? I guess I don't go to Costco to hang out and charge my vehicle. I go to my garage or I go at work, but a retail thing just seems counterintuitive to me.
Mm-hmm. Chair Beyer, Representative Berger, we expect that if somebody is parking for an hour, for example, at a shopping center or going out to lunch, they'll get about a 10 to 30 mile boost on their battery. So assuming that most people will not really need to fully charge except at home, 80% of the charging would be occurring at home, but maybe you have a few extra errands that you're running and you're going to be doing more than 100 miles of driving, or you're using your air conditioner and your radio and kind of using up some of your electricity other ways, if these are available, this is really the study, is where will people be using charging stations? Will the most popular ones be in front of a Costco? Will they be at a regional shopping center? Will they be in civic centers? Or will they be at golf courses?
There you go.
Okay.
So basically, you're trying to find out.
This is, yeah. I think you're finding a lot of pundits that have opinions, but ETEC has been in the business for well over a decade in providing charging stations, and we're still at a place where we still want to.
Madam Chair, can I pursue this just a minute, because this is interesting to me. I'm of the generation that has been dragged kicking and screaming into the cell phone world. And I have found, this is like plugging in my cell phone. Really, there's no different. I have to monitor when I'm going to use it, how much power I'm going to pull, what I want to do with it, and then get it charged in time. And only it's even more important because if my cell phone goes dead, hallelujah, nobody can reach me. But if my car goes dead, that wouldn't be a good thing.
Can't go golfing.
I can't do anything. Oh, I'd be screaming mad. I'd be mad. Just like but I can't pick it up and throw it like I can my cell phone. So I guess what you're doing here, I'm beginning to get the vision here. What you're doing is trying to figure out how people will use these, and so that when this technology begins to roll out, you'll be prepared. Am I right about that?
Well, in fact, the cars are arriving next year. Representative Beyer, Representative Berger, the cars will be arriving in small numbers. That is, we'll have maybe a couple thousand of them next year. But I anticipate that we'll see a higher percentage of electric cars rolling out than with the hybrids. We're at about 1% a year over the last 10 years. And we expect that number to be a lot higher, given that oil will be increasing in price, and there will be other incentives that relative to greenhouse gas reduction. We're putting out this mature infrastructure in this area, really, so that people will have convenient charging almost anywhere they are. If they're spending a half an hour in one location, they may choose to plug in, and then they're somewhere else for another half an hour. and they may plug in there and get a 20 or 30 mile boost if they need it. So it should be the hope of our industry is that it is as convenient as possible.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. I support what you're doing. I'm really glad we're moving. It's pretty fun to watch this stuff unfold in front of me as my life goes on. I'm confident my daughter will be driving vehicles just like this, and even more advanced when she's my age. But there's something about your message just a minute ago that really piqued my interest. Zero emissions. Nothing has, no manufactured product or any power source has zero emissions. None of them. What I'm afraid of is that your message will encourage those who think that we can all of a sudden make an immediate transition rather than a glide path out of fossil fuel and especially mm-hmm. foreign fossil fuel, because that's just simply not going to happen. Mm-hmm. Quite frankly, even power generation in this state, we're never going to meet those RPS standards. I'm fairly confident I could prove it with a little chart, mm-hmm. but I think 20 years from now, everyone will be going, yeah, that was exactly right. That's why I voted no, because it's unrealistic, unbelievable, isn't going to happen. Now, that being said, it could if people are willing to retrofit hydro, which isn't, big hydro is not in the RPS, and if we can see the light here and get some small nuclear power plants up in the state, which do have, and you don't have any source for your power plant here either. It's just like it's magic coming the power out of there. But my question, though, is I've used power outlets a lot in my work life before as a legislator, and frequent use, they wear out, they come old, they get tattered, and you're talking about a pretty high amount of power coming out of here. How are there any? Are they testing these for frequent use to where they don't cause a safety hazard? Because I looked at that. I look up here at these plastic things you got here, and if you're using it every single day, I see it wearing out. And you said there's no national standard. We have the highest building code standards in the country in this state, which I'm proud of and I want to maintain. Are these facilities at home where your average homeowner who doesn't know anything about the things I just talked about, are they going to be accepted under our existing building codes and safety standards?
Representative Beyer, Representative Schaffler, to answer first your question about them wearing out, that J1772 compliant plug is designed for abuse, okay. for driving over, for lots of abuse, and in fact, for example, the three-prong plug, 240 volt, that you would use for your dryer would wear out under much, much faster than this J1772 really? Connector. Yes, it is designed for frequent use. It is also a smart plug. That is that the juice won't run until the charging unit that we install communicates with the car, with the battery, to ensure that, yes, there is a car with a battery, it has yay so much charge in it now, and it needs yay so much, and it will accept this kind of amperage in order to transfer the electricity. And once it's communicated all that, then it starts flowing. So it's a very smart system. You can drive over some of these. You can drive over one of these charging units, and it will break, but it will not electrocute anybody because of the safety switching.
It'll especially drive over it if the brakes on the vehicle don't work.
Let me respond once to your question about the building codes. They have been a very important partner with the project, and they are on our advisory team.
And we have a couple more. And
okay, sure.
We have Representative Doherty.
Very quickly, I've noticed they look like charging stations in the Portland metropolitan area, Lake Oswego, and some other areas. Is this part of your project or?
Madam Chair, Representative Doherty, there's about 20 plus charging stations that have been installed over the past couple years, which are called level one or 120 volt charging stations in the Portland area. The ones that we are installing are 240 volt, and the level one would require about 20 hours okay. to charge a Nissan Leaf. So they're a different beast.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the reading I've done reflects the problem being the battery. which is obvious, but do you have the numbers on the cost of the battery and the carbon issues that come from having to replace it, so that when we say there's zero carbon emissions, that may be true at one level, but not so true at another. So where do we find those numbers?
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, I do not have those numbers with me. I think the main issue, these are lithium-ion batteries. There are issues relative to mining to produce the batteries. On the zero emission discussion is in fact a very important one relative to these cars, and it really depends a lot on the utility mix that is going in, that is in the electrical grid. At as an example, EWEB, which is almost all hydroelectric, is pretty close to a zero emission, whereas some of our larger utilities do rely on other sources, and where it's clean emission would be in the more in the 25 percentile range.
Follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm interested in a measure, and maybe there is one already, that shows us maybe a clearer statement of how much progress we're truly making with a device of this nature in this carbon reduction battle. So, and I know you're familiar with it, so I just, I'm curious, because that the emission piece is just such a small piece of the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
So the way I view what you're doing, it's interesting, but it looks like it's built on the hope that we will have pretty dramatic advances in battery technology, because right now much of what is going on isn't going to work all that well. I'm not saying you shouldn't do it. I'm just saying, so is it true that this is built on the hope that we'll get better batteries, or are you telling us today that you think we've reached the point that all of this is worth the effort and money?
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, I'm quite certain that better batteries are going to be developed. Having said that, the ones that are in the LEAF do provide a 100-mile range, and that is a full-speed car, a five-passenger car, which I think is rather remarkable. It is not a car that is going to suit everybody's needs, and I think that the plug-in hybrid will be something that we will see as many of on the street, and that is a car that will probably have a smaller battery and a gasoline-powered engine, and be much more efficient than the hybrids that you see on the road today. Just another point relative to carbon effect. If you are burning, for example, natural gas in a power plant and converting it to electricity and sending it to this car, you will be achieving probably a 20 or 30% efficiency over trying to burn natural gas or in other words, the power plants are much more efficient at converting than an automobile.
Madam Chair, yes. Your indulgence. The cycles that the battery, the 100-mile trip battery allows, you have the LEAF, how many times before you have to replace the battery is the question. How many 100-mile trips? 50,000 miles, 100,000 miles, do we know yet?
Chair Beyer, Representative Benz, I don't have that data with me. I suspect it's on the Nissan website. My guess is that the battery is good for a couple of years at a high usage.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. David, can you help me understand what you envision the industry looking like in 10 years from now? What I'm trying to get my arms around is, do you folks visualize these vehicles being secondary vehicles or primary vehicles with a secondary automobile? I live in rural eastern Oregon, 100 miles.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't get me to the grocery store and back. And so I'm trying to visualize what you folks see. And then I guess follow up with that. Do you see the time coming when these vehicles will have internal turbines generating their own electricity as they operate? And I know I threw a lot at you.
Yeah. Okay. Madam Chair and Representative Smith, first of all, on 10-year vision, we anticipate that we will see steady growth in electric vehicle ownership in Oregon, pure electric and as well as a hybrid. I wouldn't be surprised if we have 30 to 40,000 of these vehicles on the road in 10 years very easily. If we look at it from a policy standpoint and look at the need for greenhouse gas reduction, we may want to see 5% of our fleet being electric in terms of the sales each year. We may want that. Now, relative to is it a vehicle for all people and all uses? I would recommend that the plug-in hybrid be the car of choice in rural Oregon. On internal turbine, in fact, that the plug-in hybrid, the gasoline engine on many of these plug-in hybrids is not to turn as a drivetrain engine, but it is to create the electricity to recharge the battery. So it's sipping a very small amount of gasoline.
Thank you. Just a follow-up thought for this committee as a transportation committee, and I'm sure I'm going to get comments over this one. If your vision plays out and in 10 years we have 30 to 40,000 electric vehicles on the road, they will be providing wear and tear on our roads. Mm-hmm. Just an observation.
Thank you.
Very I'm sure good. I'm sure I'll
believe me, it
this
has
slide.
Not kind of gone over my head. I will tell you that. Can we let him finish?
Yeah, go ahead, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Okay.
I'll go ahead and finish.
Okay, this beautiful little plug over here on the right is a fast charger. Very different beast, and this is more like a gas station experience, where if you are at this using this plug for 10 minutes, you'll get a 10 to 30 mile boost. If you're there for 26 minutes, you'll be fully charged with a very large battery like is in the Nissan Leaf. So our study is relying on this data interface where we're collecting information of all sorts so that we can report back to the battery manufacturers what was the temperature that day, what was the time of the day of the charge, what was the vehicle that pulled in there and charged, what was the mileage that the vehicle got, what percentage of the battery was charged when you initiated the charge, and how much of the charge occurred in what period of time. So we are gathering information not only off the vehicle, but we have the smart meter inside the charging station that helps us gather data and transmits it to Idaho National Labs, where it's going to be turned into a huge report and information available to the industry. So we are currently in Oregon planning the deployment of these 1,000 publicly available charging stations. And in the third quarter, we're going to start building the stations, installing them, and right through next year, continuing that effort. Today, you can reserve a Nissan Leaf, and deliveries start in December of this year. Once we get the infrastructure in place and we get the vehicles with their charging stations home base, we'll be able to start our evaluation and research. We collect that weekly. Anybody that has an individual Nissan Leaf will get a report of their own charging behavior so they can see, for example, how they were acting when these cars first arrived, and then a year later how they're acting, if their behavior has changed or not. Our project is complete in 2013. We have, in terms of our process, we have done the deployment guidelines in collaboration with the Building Codes Division. We are working on our 10-year long-range plan right now, and then we're also working on maps with ODOT for density and distribution patterns for the charging stations. So, if you have constituents, if you have any business owners who you think would like to have some publicly available charging stations at low or no cost, let me know. And you can reach me at this email address. Just a couple of pitches here with the Betsy programs that the charging stations do apply or can be aligned with Betsy. We would recommend that there be caps to the unit cost. For example, how much is available through Betsy for a charging unit. Right now, we're out there trying to provide cost-effective units, and I guess we'd like to see the Betsy program go ahead and cap the amount that's available to spend on those units. We also hope that you support the smart metering aspect of the electric vehicle charging stations, because the smart metering will support that smart grid, and that smart grid will save a lot of investment in electric grid infrastructure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. I really am fascinated what you're doing, and I support what you're doing, and I appreciate what you're doing, and someday I'll probably own one of these when I don't need to carry my wheelbarrow and a few sheets of plywood around in my Leaf. But, you know, I just got to return back to what I said earlier. You talked about the mining. You know, we have the strongest safety, labor, environmental standards in the world in this country, and we still have coal mines obviously caving in, Massey mine, due to a lot of things that will be sorted out. But what you don't have on here is you don't have a manufacturing plant, you don't have a mine, you do have a farm, that's good, we've got something going, it's all service over here, and my friend's golf course. I'm interested in my friend from Hepner's question about 10 years from now. I want to see manufacturing plants hooked into this in America. Because, you know, we're importing stuff from countries that don't have those standards I just talked about. There's a coal mine collapses in China every week, it seems. And the coal they're using is not clean coal like we're trying to figure out here in this country. And I'll be quite frank with you, as much as I support what you're doing, I think it's a wash. I think we're still, I know for a fact we're extracting natural resources from the ground, and we're still providing energy for ourselves and these products. And if the powers that be in Detroit would have had their act together decades ago, they probably could have come up with an efficient carburation system. And been efficient as this. They probably still could. But in the meantime, my union of brothers and sisters are losing their job, and Detroit's a wasteland. But so unless you have that tacked onto here, because these businesses here, they will not survive unless you have a manufacturing component here in this country. They will go broke. No one will need to have a Leaf. No one will be able to drive anywhere. So unless we start doing that, I just don't see it happening. But the zero emission, sir, is simply not true. And I hope you don't ever use that term again in your presentation, because it's not zero emission. But thank you. I do support what you're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've been doing some thought processes on, you know, alternative fuel vehicles, and but in your mind, the public charging stations, is there a cost? Are you recovering the cost of charging at these stations?
Mm-hmm. Part of our grant is to provide this network of charging stations so that we can gather the data, and it's at low or no cost relative to installation, putting in the conduit from the panel to the charging station location. So we do all that, and then we provide a charging station unit. The owner, the property owner, is responsible for the electricity for the study period. We have the ability to charge. I mean, for there to be a cost associated with that through an RFID card that turns on the unit, and that will be available should customers decide to do that sometime in the future.
Briefly, one more. And these will be installed by licensed electricians here in the state of Oregon, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, yes.
Good.
All the electrical work is. We have a network of licensed installers that are go through the selection process with Equitality North America, and they are here locally, and they will be doing the work. One additional comment is that all of our units are U.S. made.
And forgive me, following up. I didn't say installer. I said electricians, as in they went through an apprenticeship program. They're licensed journeyman electricians, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, that the electrical work will all be done by licensed electricians.
Thank you.
Representative Doherty.
My question, looking at this, and it's nice to have something that is clean, maybe not zero, but how is this going to affect, for example, if you've got $2 million less than, or 20 million, 2 million gallons less of fuel, what the effect of this is on fuel taxes and money that goes to highways in Oregon and so mm-hmm. on? Mm-hmm. And conversely, is this something that would be maybe added on to the charging stations?
Mm-hmm. Chair Beyer and
I know it's a guesstimation.
This is a very good point. Clearly, as funding for transportation infrastructure is declining, this point needs to be addressed.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. And so we now have a panel. Our last panel on seismic safety advisory commission recommendations on transportation, which I think is somewhat a follow-up from a report we heard in February. And I'll go ahead and let
this is the collapsing bridges, right?
Thanks. Columbia's going to follow in soon. We can do something about it.
To introduce yourselves today.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Yume Wong here to represent OSPAC. To my left is Jim Doan. He's also a member of OSPAC and he's the past chair. Mark Tyler, member of OSPAC and the chair of the Education and Communications Committee. And Bill Cross here to represent Susan Stewart, who is the committee chair of the Strategic Planning Committee. And last but not least is Representative Debbie Boone. And Representative Boone is also one of us on OSPAC. So we're here to follow up on the presentation from last time. And we have prepared some slides, so there's a lot of slides, so I think I'll just actually jump into that. Let's see. So thank you for having us here. OSPAC isn't really a household name, so it's basically the Earthquake Commission. It's the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission. We have a statute, and it says all these things about reducing the exposure to earthquake hazards and influencing existing agencies, and to also to advise the governor and legislative assembly. So to follow up on that number three, it's to advise on legislative proposals and plans and so forth with a statewide impact. And so that's why we're here today. We have 18 members on the commission. The ones up on top are in green are the ones represented here today. It's a mix of public and state agencies and stakeholders. And just to summarize the ODOT report from last time, they let you know that after doing an engineering study that the ODOT bridges, they looked at the bridges in the western part of the state, would have major problems in a Cascadia earthquake. And a Cascadia earthquake is the most likely large natural disaster that we would have in the state of Oregon. And then they specified some details like the Highway 101 would basically be down. There would be mobility problems between the coast and the highway. I'm sorry, the coast and I-5, as well as having problems right along I-5. From a Cascadia earthquake, there would be about $1 billion of damage to the bridges. And at their current pace of strengthening the 900-some bridges that they feel are seismically vulnerable and the priority bridges, it's going to take them over 200 years to strengthen them. So our commission had a few things to think about that. We heard from ODOT about a month after they presented to you. So they presented to you here in February. They came to our March commission meeting and gave the exact same talk, and we thought, wow, that's a really good study that they did. They have excellent engineers, excellent emergency managers. We have one of their emergency managers on the commission. They have, they've done a lot of very forward-thinking work. But with the results from the study, we were, of course, highly concerned about the reliability of the transportation system, and we think that state action is needed. So we're here to suggest to you a draft policy on seismic transportation reliability. So this would be to have a new plan, seismic transportation reliability plan, as well as having a new program. OSPAC has had successes in helping with earthquake preparedness in several areas, including laws that require large employers to do earthquake drills, laws that require existing schools and emergency facilities to fix them in case they're very vulnerable, as well as a couple of other things. Seismic safety improvements that we've been able to help contribute have, by and large, been passed off to the legislature to help make these actions. Make them happen. So these two draft policies I'll get to at the end with a little bit of detail, but they've been agreed upon by the OSPAC leadership. The OSPAC leadership is going to vote on this in a couple of days, and the goal is really to provide a legislative concept for the legislature to move forward on seismic transportation reliability. So we have collected a number of slides here to kind of present the problem, and as ODOT had discussed, we sit in a seismic area where there's a large fault offshore, the Cascadia subduction zone, and this could create a very large earthquake, magnitude 9. The Department of Geology has done predictive models that suggest that we would have over 5,000 fatalities in Oregon from such an earthquake, with about $30 billion of building damage. This isn't including the $1 billion of ODOT bridge damage, as well as over 35,000 buildings that are closed. And most of the damage would come from tsunami damage, areas of poor soils, and weak infrastructure. So I just got back from Chile. I'm an earthquake engineer. And so I have some pictures in here of transportation damage and wanted to relate the two, because the Chile earthquake that occurred a few months ago is a very close analog to what we're going to have here in Oregon. It's a subduction zone setting, and Chile is very modern. It's very much like us in a number of ways. They have the same geology, the same geography with the coast ranges and valley and the volcanic range. They have, the type of industry that we have, fishing industry, timber industry, wine, and agriculture, and so forth. The thing that they've had to their advantage, to their great advantage, is that they've had seismic codes put in place much earlier than we have. Their bridge building codes were put in place in the 50s. Their building codes for their buildings were put in place in like the 1900s, whereas in Oregon, our seismic building codes weren't implemented until the 1990s. So here's just some statistics. They were very lucky because their large earthquake, a magnitude 8.8, hit them in a very low tide, so their tsunami damage was minimal. And they also were hit at the end of summer, so they had very few landslides where we would be, you know, statistically speaking, we would be hit by a harder tsunami and more landslides. They're very lucky with only 500 fatalities. Here's some stats, which are really, they had a very good outcome. About 300 of their bridges had damage. And this is, the yellow dots are basically the Chilean earthquake. It's not just one spot, but there's a lot of aftershocks and so forth. And that area is maybe 700 kilometers or so. So the areas that they had damage to their transportation system were really areas hit by the tsunami, areas with poor soils, and areas where they had weak infrastructure, like, you know, weak bridges. So I'm going to go through these series of pictures really quickly because I had a hard time just reducing it down to these. But, you know, things that float get picked up by the tsunami and they get slammed around. And here's some boats that slammed into a bridge. And you know, other things also pick up and float, whether it's containers or buildings or cars. In this area of the coast, it was permanently uplifted, the whole region, by about 6 feet. So, you know, some pretty big geologic things happen. This is just a bridge that got hit by a tsunami. And this little bridge was out of service. They had some fill that they put in there, which handled their situation temporarily. This large bridge here also was picked up and floated by a tsunami a little bit on the other side. So they had to restrict the traffic movement. The tsunami here, this is a coastal town, was about 36 feet high, the surges, so it's pretty significant. If you look under the bridge, you can see that the red thing here, the girder, got picked up and moved in to the left, and it's not centered right on here, as well as some cross members here. Here's some size, I'll go into this. This shear key, which is there to hold the bridge in place, got moved out to the right. And it's not just bridges, the pavement can float. You know, towns that are in the tsunami zone, coastal low-lying areas, can get hit. This is a small town of Dichato, and I think of Representative Devoon when I see this, because it's kind of similar to Cannon Beach. About 70% of the homes were destroyed. They were lucky with very few fatalities, just 17. But the thing is, if your emergency facilities are in the area that gets flooded, such as this fire station, then they're not there to help you. So this is something that means additional transportation from out of the areas is important. Okay, on to the second area that causes damage. When you have poor soils in an area, they can respond very badly. And soils that are subject to liquefaction, like wet, sandy soils, can temporarily turn into a liquid. We call it liquefaction. This is obviously not a very good outcome. I should say with this really was kind of the poor sucker, because it got hit by the tsunami. It also it had soil problems. So that's number two. And number three was just like an old bad bridge. So it had the triple play. The approach didn't do well. The abutment didn't do well. And the bridge didn't do well. This is a different bridge, and it's closed to traffic. You can see it's a little bumpy here. This is a liquefaction sand boil. It's like a little mini volcano of sand that comes out of the ground. When that happens, you know, the ground can also move. But one of the things about this bridge, which is nice, is they had actually four parallel bridges in this area. It's a coastal town. All four of them had significant problems, but since they had four, they were able to pick one of them to put up a temporary bridge, which was great. These things, you know, you can put them in place very quickly. And so the ground around here moved. You can see that the ground settled and moved out this way, but they had a temporary measure. And even to be able to get the temporary bridge in there, which is a good solution, you know, to be able to get it there quickly requires transportation. And there's also other, you know, little types of transportation that are issues. This is just a pedestrian bridge and culverts. These things are essentially bridges, but they go out into the water. So this one failed because of poor soils. And what happened is the ground just moves out this way and brings whatever is on it with it. Another wharf here. And this is the Navy facility that has significant damage right in their wharf area. And, you know, hopefully the Navy would actually be there to help assist in an emergency. And just some more lateral spreading. This is kind of easy to see because it pulls the asphalt apart. I was at one location where these containers were just kind of spread out throughout the bay because they pick up and float as well. Well, unless we all have electric cars, I guess, we rely on fossil fuel. The refinery there had some problems, and it was closed. It will probably be closed about six months, and these are just two of the crude oil pipelines that bring the crude oil into the refinery. And then the refinery itself had some problems, including the storage facilities. The transportation sector also relies on electricity. This is high voltage transmission tower that failed because of poor soils, and then it pulled the two towers on either side of it down. Okay, third area. We just looked at some tsunami damage. We just looked at damage from poor soils. And the third area with damage is really when you have weak transportation, weak infrastructure, whether it's a building or a bridge. From the bridge standpoint, the areas that you see damage, and ODOT explained this last time, is that you can have problems with your foundation, your substructure above your foundation, and then the superstructure, the deck-type stuff. And in Chile's case, the bridges really failed, mostly because of poor connections. But you saw some other problems as well from foundation failures and so forth. And this is just a highway overpass near the Santiago Airport area. And my understanding is that someone died here, just one person. And this freeway structure was built about 10, 15 years ago. So old infrastructure like this. This is one of those beautiful bridges that kind of just outspent its lifetime. It's not surprising that it failed. And this one is the other one, the one that you saw. Basically, was not designed to take lateral shaking from an earthquake. The bearing seats weren't long enough. And this is that one highway where the cars were kind of piled up. You can see here that they have two parallel bridge structures, but unfortunately, both of them had the same problem, so both of them failed. This one is at a little bit of an angle, askew, and so when the earthquake comes, it kind of rotates. And in this case, it pulled out these shear keys, as well as blew out these end members for lateral restraint. These were new, so, you know, this was just, they were getting sloppy there. The government didn't build this. This was the private sector that built this in Chile, and so the ODOT government, Ministry of Public Works, is looking into how they work with the private industry there a little bit better. They have Route 5, which is just like our I-5. And just like our I-5, in many places, there are parallel bridges. They had the older bridge and a newer bridge when they were increasing the capacity. The older bridge here failed, and they were very lucky that they could just route everything onto the newer bridge. So this is what it looked like driving down. Engineers always like to have redundancy, so if you have a couple of options, it improves your chance. You also want to worry about your overcrossings because these things can fall down onto your highway. It's very quick if you have the equipment there to just shove it off to the side of the road. This one didn't collapse, but you can see that they required a lot of shoring to make sure that it doesn't collapse. There's a picture of me. I'm standing up here where this guy is directing the limited traffic here. And then the airports themselves had some problems as well. This is Santiago Airport. The control tower just had some structural damage. And this is, you know, looks bad, but it's non-structural damage. A bunch of things kind of bang around inside, so it takes a while to clean up. The rails also had problems. A lot of the rail buildings were these older, you know, very nice-looking buildings, but they don't perform well in earthquakes, as well as I actually saw a rail, one of these heavy-gauge things that pulled apart. And this is just to remind you, you already know this, but there are a lot of co-location issues and interdependency issues. On our bridges, we often string water mains and other important infrastructure, as well as this is the new bridge. This is Route 5 with the new bridge that failed, and the old bridge remained standing. And this new bridge, of course, goes over a rail line, and so they have to clean that up before getting the rail going. So we have some take-home lessons for Oregon. You know, one, we should be thinking about the areas along the coast that are right in the tsunami zone. So not all the areas along the coast are at risk, just the really low-lying, extensive low-lying areas. But there are certainly highways, you know, that go through those areas. Areas of poor soils, we have a lot of these. We can't think about all of them, but maybe we can be concerned about the important lifelines, the important routes through that go through poor soils, as well as weak infrastructure. And ODOT mentioned that they have about 900 bridges. I think that you know, Oregon wouldn't have money to fix all 900 bridges this year, but, you know, maybe at the rate that they're going, maybe 4 or 5 a year, make sure that those are strategically selected so that they're on important priority routes. This is Cannon Beach, where this was hit in earthquake that was in an earthquake that was generated in 1964 in Alaska, created a tsunami that came and hit. Of course, it hit Alaska, and then it came and hit the Oregon coast as well. And this bridge structure, it floated like bridges do if they get hit by tsunamis. And part of it went over here. Part of it went over here. So that's bad news. It was replaced. The replacement bridge would also have the same type of problem. And the elementary school is right over there. Oregon's fuel supply is really in one place. We really have all of our eggs in one basket. We get our fuel mostly from the Puget Sound, either from pipeline or ship. And the fuel tank farms are all right here on the lower Willamette River, all on very liquefiable soil. And so the PUC, the Oregon PUC, and the Oregon Department of Energy in Dogami are working on improving the seismic reliability of our fuel for the state of Oregon.
What was the yellow line on that slide?
Yeah, I was trying to ignore this. This is the Portland Hills fault. So
I kind of thought that was what that was. Go on.
Yeah, the Portland Hills are there because of the Portland Hills fault.
Right.
The fault kind of shut the hills up.
I thought it was a liquid natural gas line.
No. In your dreams.
Well, the LNG think, also sits down in this area. We have two in the state of Oregon. One's
right.
here and one's down in Newport.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Really quick, you made mention that steps are being taken to work on the fuel supply, and I'm not sure I understood that interpretation correctly. What steps are being taken?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, that's a tough question. But so the PUC, Dogami, and ODO, the Department of Energy, earlier this year received a grant from the U.S. Department of Energy to evaluate the energy assurance of the state of Oregon, and that includes the fuel supply. It includes electricity, because electricity, you know, the last speaker, obviously that means that there's going to be a bigger electricity draw if you have a lot of electric cars driving around. As well as natural gas. So we've worked with all of the companies, the privately owned, investor-owned companies, as well as all of the petroleum companies to, one, increase the earthquake awareness, and two, encourage them to do seismic vulnerability assessments of their system. And three, we will be suggesting risk management steps similar to what we're suggesting here. The framework's a little bit different between the electricity and natural gas than the petroleum folks. But we've had several workshops, tabletop exercises. We have visited visited facilities that all of them own. Does that help at all?
And we're getting close to the noon hour, and we probably could go over just a little bit. I want to make sure everybody gets to talk. So,
okay, so let me go quicker. But one thing, this is just a close up of one of the piers there, and you can see that I could probably kick this thing over. It's built a while ago. And BPA has done studies here where they think that from an earthquake, these towers can move out by 25 feet, which wouldn't be very good. This is an ODOT bridge designed to far short of what would be expected to be necessary by today's standards. And so we, just to review, we have earthquakes, we have vulnerable transportation system, and so let me move on. Oh, this is my last slide. So what we are suggesting here is that there are two steps taken, one, to develop a plan, and two, to develop a program. A program that's funded that would help implement the plan, with a task force to help oversee the plan implementation. As far as the plan, what we would suggest is a holistic approach to look at not only the bridges, but also how to get from point A to point B. So look at the highways. There are areas where you'll have landslide problems and tsunami problems. There are areas where you'll go over locally owned bridges in addition to state-owned bridges. And there are areas where you would worry about what is actually on the bridges. You know, not to reinvent the wheel here, but to utilize all the expertise ODOT has and their programs that they have to actually get this plan developed. Thank you.
Okay, who's next?
Oh. I just have a follow-up question.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Earlier this morning in our presentation, each of us were provided with a list of potential road projects or current road projects that are under construction. Are these projects being coordinated with your efforts?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, that's a great question. I see
Madam Chair, Clark's coming up. I just, if I may, briefly? You know, nobody talks about this seismic stuff related to transportation, or for that matter, mapping the floor, the seed, or be prepared for this, and the statewide communication for emergency response, more than one of your members, my good friend, Representative Debbie Boone. She really is a champion for you. And then, Doug, I guess while you're up here, my question to the nice lady was, can we use state gas tax money to make this plan? And the federal government has to step in here. We cannot do this by ourselves. I've asked that question before in this committee, but so there you go.
Joe Beyer, Representative Smith, first. The way that we prepare that list of projects that's in there is based on our condition reports for preservation for pavements and for bridge, seismic being one of the factors. However, most of the projects in there, anytime we do a bridge project, we do it to what's called a level one seismic standard, so there's some protection. Level two seismic standard would allow you to have that bridge functional within 72 hours. Unfortunately, we don't have enough money. We wouldn't do very many projects. So we balance between doing projects to keep the system in general in operation and do seismic protection. What we are doing with Dog Ami, it's not like this is an independent effort. We are with Dog Ami updating our lifeline routes, because we do have a lifeline route map that Dog Ami pointed out was could be better in some ways, and so that we can add that in as a prioritization factor. So the answer to the question is we think about that, but it's not the total guiding reason for the expenditure.
Just as a quick follow-up, and I appreciate that, and I appreciate the comments that are shared earlier. I guess my observation is if we had an earthquake of magnitude 9 or similar, that we should just fully anticipate that we're going to have a heck of a lot of infrastructure that's destroyed. And as Representative Schaffler pointed out, we're going to be turning with our hand out to the federal government saying, help.
Correct. Chair Beyer, Representative Schaffler, yes, we can spend state gas tax dollars to do the seismic, both the necessary planning for the lifeline routes and the retrofits. What we do spend, and goes along with Representative Smith's question, our highway program is based on both federal and state funding. We get both monies, and they're both mixed in when we're doing the preservation or the bridge work. We don't separate those two out, but we can spend state highway funds. And we do, and we can spend federal funds, and we do.
And Representative Boone, did you have a comment?
I did. Thank you all for coming today. It's very important. And just as a plug, OSPAC will be meeting Wednesday here in room 50 from 9 to noon. So if you're available, you can see that. And I just wanted to point out that UMA's slide on Cannon Beach from 1964 is much different than it looks today, a lot more building, a lot more homes, and the very sobering fact is the entire physical print of Cannon Beach, among other towns along the coast, are in the inundation zone and will be affected. So Cannon Beach, Rockaway, Gearhart Seaside, and on down the coast. But it was very sobering fact to me to see Dr. Chris Goldfinger from the Oregon State University Seafloor Mapping Lab overlay I don't know what you call it, like a little map of Cannon Beach over the Banda Aceh site, and it almost matches exactly, and it would be the exact same effect in that sense. Also, Pacific City.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah. Don't think you're getting out of this.
So,
so it's very serious.
Who's next? And we'll.
Madam Chair, representatives, on a more human aspect is as far as...
Go ahead and identify yourself.
Oh, Mark Tyler, Chair of the OSPAC Education and Communication Committee. With respect to students and workers around the state, depending on the day and time that a major earthquake could hit, there could be either students in schools employees at work. If it was at night, people wouldn't go to work or be able to go to school. But if students were, say, caught in school or on school buses on the way home or to school, with the collapse of our highway system, there would be quite a bit of concern by students and parents on either the well-being of their children or spouses, and the ability for emergency services to reach those areas would be definitely hampered. And so on you know, on behalf of OSPAC, it would be a very good effort for ODOT to begin looking at these emergency routes as lifelines. And so I guess just on, you know, on a human side of it, looking out for children and our public in general. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there more testimony here? We have a couple more people here. We can, you can talk fast, right?
Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Bill Cross, and I'm representing BOMA, the commercial building owners, who are part of OSPAC. And I've learned one thing over the years, that when it gets to be lunchtime, it's probably a good time for us to leave. But we will be back. We do have some recommendations that we'd like to present next session. And obviously, it's a very, very critical issue.
Thank you. So, we're given that.
Madam Chair, I would like to thank you for agreeing to hear this panel today. And such short notice, too, because it's important. And to be, you know, we're always told on things like this, you know, well, we can wait until September, we can wait till the next. But in a case like this, I think the quicker we move, the better, and the more outreach, the more education. And that's been very instructive. And I know there are a billion people watching us on the internet right now, so as many people who can find out about this and the seriousness of it, the better. So thank you all for coming.
And did you have any last comments? I thought I saw you reaching for the mic. No?
I was just going to thank you, Chair Beyer, and members of the committee for having us here and for listening to our thoughts about how to possibly improve the seismic transportation reliability in Oregon.
Thank you. And before I let you go, I just, to those billion people that are out there watching us, the slides you saw, if you weren't paying attention, were not Oregon, with the exception of one. We're just looking at this to make sure they aren't ever Oregon. So I just wanted to make that clear. So thank you for coming. And I'm trying to remember if there was something else I needed to touch base on. But thank committee for all the suggestions, and we will get them scheduled and as we move along. And to say that, thank you for coming. It really was a great hearing. I think it's important that we look at what we have accomplished in the last couple years and what we're seeing being built now, and as we, the jobs that are out there, and all the flaggers that are working on our roads. And just remember, these are hardworking people, good jobs, and they will be done eventually, and you will be able to move freely again. And thank you, and we're adjourned.